Well, I'm very honored to be here this morning, and I want to thank Gwen for that great introduction. I want to begin my talk with a who knows the definition of an expert? Anyone know? Well, the one I keep hearing, or that I used to hear, was someone from far away with slides. That's actually the old definition. The new definition is someone from far away with PowerPoint. Unfortunately, I'm not an expert. I failed the test. I have PowerPoint. You see that already. But unlike Ellen, who gave a wonderful talk last night, who is an expert, and unlike the fact that when I travel to California, as I did a few months ago, or Tel Aviv, as I did last year, I'm an expert there, but I'm not an expert here. Here in Montgomery, I'm a fellow citizen. I don't pay taxes yet to Montgomery County, but I will be shortly. My wife and I are in the process of buying a house in Montgomery. Here's where we're renting at the moment. And I didn't ride my bike. I didn't ride my bike all the way here, but I rode about 10 minutes to the MARC train and jumped on the train for about 5 minutes and then rode from the station. And I have my bike here as evidence to show it. And that's my daughter, Lily, who I'm now trying to work into every PowerPoint I do. And that was about 2 days ago. I ran her down the hill to her school. And since Ellen got to show her book last night, I'm going to show mine. After 20 years, believe it or not, it's still in print. I get a check, not for a lot every year, but it's out there selling. And I really enjoyed this sort of revolutionary spirit of those early years. Now new urbanism, smart growth, they've sort of gone mainstream, but I couldn't believe my eyes when this issue of Newsweek came out in 1995 with 13 pages and a cover story. It just blew me away, and that really put the issues that we're all talking about here today on the map for the first time. The idea that living on a cul-de-sac in the largest possible house maybe wasn't the best thing you could hope for. And as Gwen mentioned, I had a chance to steer the ship of CNU in its early years with some very active board members, and they continue to be active. Had a chance to build a relationship with the federal government over affordable housing issues with Henry Cisneros shown addressing our Congress. I'm going to forgive Roger Lewis for leaving my beard out of the cartoon, but he swears to me that that is me holding up the charter at our Charleston Congress, starting to feel like old times. And again, the Form-Based Code Institute bringing forward something that at the time seemed rather revolutionary, the idea that one could actually leave the concept of zoning behind and focus on a different approach that looked at the form of buildings. Not totally leave it behind, but a different relationship. Well, I did, you know, my wife always gets on me. She says, you know, Peter, you're out lecturing as an advocate. People don't know what you really do. I don't just speak. There are, you know, I once upon a time there was enough lectures, but what I do in between is I work as a consultant, and these are the fancy words, but basically I help developers get entitlements for really great projects, for projects that are often big and complex and typically smart growth or new urbanism, but awfully hard to get past the public. One of them's here in Montgomery County, actually Rockville, different municipality, but it was called Upper Rock. It's just off I-270, which is the north-south road, and Shady Grove. It's actually, I helped to get the project approved. The plan is by Duane and Plater Zyberk, and here's what they started with, which was a newly built, I think a 9-story tower with government in it, a lower building dating about 15 years older. Andres Duane back in, I think, 2004 had this idea of trying to make a place in the suburbs that would appeal to the creatives, which at that time was a kind of an exotic idea. Today, everybody's talking about millennials this, millennials that. And I kind of thought to myself, well, you know, dream on, trying to get folks like them living in the burbs. But he said, no, 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 let's do this. And this is the plan. The buildings had a lot of green features that never made it into the final, but basically a group of Texas wraps wrapping around the existing buildings right off the exit ramp. Again, I worked on the branding. We had the idea of calling it Montgomery County's first post-suburban community. I guess if you're technical, Kentlands maybe might be that. Helped with public relations. We got this article in USA Today One of their editors traveled down to Texas to Legacy Business Park, one of the projects Ellen talked about last night. We got a mention, and all these things, the presentation here a little more convincingly showing how they would go from their existing entitlements, which would have lost the developer quite a lot of money, because I think they'd spent close to $20 million for the property. Here is the project in its full glory, obviously earning a decent return. And again, some images showing the transition from what they started with, addition of some kind of cool solar panel window awnings, and showing how it would build out and become a real street. Well, JBG did get their entitlements. Matt Herson ran that project. He's now at Hines. This is what was built. You know, it's not exactly what was in the Duane images, but it's a very successful project from a leasing standpoint. Unfortunately, they had a terrible fire there a few weeks ago. Very sad to see. But, you know, really showing that you can create a there in the burbs. As also as mentioned, I have worked as a planner. During the toughest years of the recession, I found shelter in local government and learned a lot. Learned how different things are done in different parts of the country. Hugely different. And, of course, planners don't get around a lot. They tend to stay in one region. And when you do jump from region to region, you sort of go, wow, this is really different. The other thing you learn is that some of my more theoretical friends in the new urbanism are saying things that aren't necessarily implementable. And it's a tough issue because the new urbanists, a lot of them are architects. They didn't come up through local government. And I'm not saying local government has the answers either, but there's something in that intersection trying to figure out how government operates and what's important to new urbanists and smart growthers that needs to be solved. Now, as was mentioned, I've been working a lot on the fiscal side. I came into this with an interest in design. I moved to the regulatory. Now I'm in the fiscal. I don't know how that happened because I'm not a numbers person. But I do understand the basic principles. And I'm very pleased to see that Smart Growth America in their Building Better Budgets program has confirmed and amplified a lot of the findings we had several years before them. But rather than get talking about numbers, I'm going to talk about how we experience the problem and why zoning is actually hurting the bottom line for America's municipalities. The system that is ubiquitous, that's been in place since the 20s, that is the law of the land, believe it or not, the way it functions hurts our tax base. Let me explain. So here we are, typical Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday in a typical municipality, developer presenting a project. We don't know what's on the other side of those boards. I'm going to presume that it's a great smart growth mixed use project with a good deal of density that's going to put a lot of tax base into the community. Here's the first witness up. He's obviously a friend of the developer. He said, a friend of mine zoned a business, blah, blah, blah. The zoning attorney sitting in the front row looks guardedly pleased. Here's the next person up. She's a citizen. She's saying what the community clearly wanted to see. Look at the expression on the zoning attorney's face. He is not happy with that. Here was before, for comparison, A, B, okay? Well, generally what is discussed in these meetings are quality of life issues versus the impacts of the development. And to the extent that the development has impacts, often what happens in those hearings is the scope and scale of the project gets reduced. The buildings get lower, they get pushed back further from the street, they get smaller. Unfortunately, government's obligations to service that development, even though the pipe has gotten smaller because there are less units, they still have to dig the trench, they have to pave the road. Government has to do a lot of things that cost a lot of money to enable that development to happen. But it gets less return because of that process of zoning constantly chipping away. The project got rejected. Unfortunately, issues related to revenue never came up. The CFO didn't come out to the planning meeting. He typically doesn't. That's the planner's business. No one was really looking out for the bottom line for the municipality, and the planners were told they were supposed to be neutral. It's a very important idea. Planners believe they're supposed to be neutral. I'm not sure that really should be. Because government's on the hook for huge costs if developments don't earn out. So it's a very complex process, as we all know who's involved in it, lots and lots of steps. And when something actually gets to the end and a project is built and issued a CFO, lots of, you tend to get lost among the trees. Oftentimes, though, what will get built in a controversial situation is the default setting, the thing that looks the most like where this woman lives. Because she can't come out and criticize her own neighborhood. She can't come out and say, well, houses like mine are the problem. So the default is, well, okay, I'll end up with something that looks like my house. The problem with this is it's what I call a time bomb under the street. It's not literally going to blow up. But this place was built with impact fees, typically paid by the developer, to bridge the gap between the costs that government was putting out to service this place and what the developer, what the project would pay in taxes. So they recognized that to get this thing in, you need a big Band-Aid. The problem is 30 years out, there's no one with a Band-Aid. These houses won't look quite as snappy as they do when they're first built. The neighborhood might have even not done so well. And the problem is with money bleeding out, the local government's going to turn to the citizens here and he's going to say, guys, you've got problems with your pipes, you've got problems with your roads, I'm afraid we're going to have to do an assessment, and you're paying. Creates all kinds of hostility. People are not happy when that happens. And, you know, impact fees, which was a great invention at the time because it let our suburban paradigm carry forward, are problematic because of a number of things. They don't let you put the money in the general fund. You have to spend them near where the impacts are created. A whole number of issues that really militate against smart growth. Here's a $38 million check that the county's writing in Sarasota, Florida, for all kinds of improvements necessitated by a new shopping center. And citizens, of course, we were just plunging into the recession there. Citizens were freaking out. The planners said, oh, don't worry. It's just a pass-through. The developer's paying the money. And they're right. The problem is, even as a pass-through, it's problematic because it's forcing the county to build a lot of roads and a lot of infrastructure that it won't have money for in 30 years or 40 years. Now, I did work in Sarasota County, which is probably, as it happens, the extreme in terms of how bad things could get. There's a terrific report by the Pew Charitable Trust called The Local Squeeze that singles out Sarasota for a number of superlatives in terms of greatest amount of value lost on its tax base. It had nothing to do with me. I showed up when it was already happening. But one of the important things to remember is that development, particularly in places like Florida, permit fees, all kinds of money emanating from the construction process are what drive, they're what paid my salary. So there's a natural tendency to see a lot of development come through the pipeline to entitle a lot of projects. But I think folks have said that the state of Florida is entitled for something like 10 times more units than it could ever possibly hold. I don't have the statistic at my fingertips. But my boss, Jim Lay, as we were swirling down the toilet in the Great Recession, said, look, we don't really know what's paying the bills. We know that the one thing that'll save us is property tax for new construction. We got to figure this thing out, and we got to explain to our citizens why it's important for us to keep building. But it's also important to figure out what's the kind of development that pays the bills, and I have no clue. I'm guessing it's suburban sprawl. Peter, why don't you find out? So we did a study that was recently written up in Government Finance Review, which goes out to many, many government CFOs and controllers all over the country. That's only the most recent publication, but what we were looking at is a very simple thing. What is the tax yield per acre, per year, for various kinds of properties in the county? Everything from self-storage to ag land and so on. And I'm going to walk you through the study as it's shown in the magazine. So we're going to start with the low end. Out in the county, a typical single-family house sitting on an acre of land, or three or four sitting on an acre together, pay overall, on average, about $3,650. Multifamily pays about double that, you'd expect it to. And the single-family house in the city of Sarasota, where I live, that wasn't my house, but it was around the corner, pays about $8,211, reflecting the higher level of services you get in an incorporated municipality. Now, the first big surprise in the study, you would think that big box would pay a whole lot more. You just would assume that. But surprise, surprise, the brand new Walmart shopping center constructed in the southern part of the county only pays about $150 more per acre per year. And you can bet that property is requiring a lot more in the way of infrastructure from the county. big road widenings, all kinds of intersection improvements. Now, some of that will be dealt with impact fees, but again, very big questions to whether those even cover the first pass. So, you know, big, big surprise. As we move down through the commercial offerings from the Walmart, we go to a regional mall further out, grocery anchored shopping center. You see they're moving up 13, 15. Finally, our very best mall with Saks Fifth Avenue and Macy's and Dillard's close in earning almost $22,000, three times the Walmart. But it's close in, it's on incorporated city land, it's on a big arterial. They're paying taxes also to the city as well. So there's our commercial. Now what I just did is I just reduced down the size of those bars, and we're going to stretch the chart out now to 1.2 million right here, blowing it up. Now what if our best mall is paying 21,000, is there, do you have any idea what could possibly be paying 1.2 million? I mean, you know, what could it be? Well, we'll get there. Let's start with this building in the heart of downtown, built in 1923 as part of a hotel. The top floor sits empty. The downstairs is a kind of a cool shop. It's paying about $90,000, roughly 10 times the Walmart. Probably mostly because it's well located, but you know, a lot of people look at these old buildings and say, you got to tear it down, it's obsolete. This building's doing fine in terms of taxes. We'll blow that up. And again, four times the best mall. Okay, think about that. 4-to-1 ratio. Here's across the street a building built in 1926 as a bank building, turned into condos, just under 800,000, about 100 times the Walmart. And finally, in 2006, a 17-story condo with beautiful units, but not unobstructed ocean views. Only a few of the units have those blue water views that people pay so much for in Florida, just under 1.2 million. So you compare that Walmart at 8,000 to this one at 1.2 million, and you go, holy cow, now we know what's paying the bills. Downtown, for all the abuse it takes, is the financial engine of the county. And this was something that was a little tough for us because I was with the county. There's a separate incorporated municipality, the city of Sarasota, that is doing the approvals on all that stuff getting built. And they're not talking about revenue because it goes to us. So interesting issues. But a couple of superlatives. Those two malls, the Walmart Center and the best mall, Westfield, together they pay $1.145 million on 55 acres. That's actually $350,000 less than this one building in downtown on two-thirds of an acre. Now, I'm adding city and county tax together for this one. Up to now, I've only been talking about county tax and only property tax, not sales tax. Few more statistics. It takes 145 acres of Walmart to equal the revenue earned by that one building, 1350, that sits on just two-thirds of an acre. So and the Walmart itself is only about 20 acres, 20, 30 acres, I think. What about sales tax? Well, glad you asked. Let's talk about it. For the county, our sales tax take is less than a quarter of our property tax. We get in about $61 million. In property, you get in about $222. That was in 2008, the year this study was done. But if you think about it, what if our citizens said, you know, we're here in Florida, we're retired, thank you very much for having no income tax, but we really hate that sales tax. Could we get rid of it here in Sarasota County? What if we were to take this one building that generates just over $1 million on two-thirds of an acre and do 60 of them? Which looks like a lot. It looks like Manhattan, but actually, to fully replace what everybody pays in sales tax forever, you could basically achieve it on just 100 acres in our downtown, which is about 600 acres, and still have room left over for streets and a town square and all kinds of good stuff. Might be a little intense for Sarasotans, but if you look at the downtown today, you see that most of the buildings are actually one- and two-story buildings. There's a few near the edges, near the water, and a couple big corporate buildings that are 10, 12 stories, but most are pretty shrimpy. And that's the place where people would say, okay, put some buildings here. Now, if you go an hour north to St. Petersburg, you'll see about that amount of construction that happened in the last boom. And you know that picture of the beautiful street on the bottom. As it happened, St. Petersburg didn't turn into a terrible place when all that square footage got built. In fact, a lot of the restaurants that were barely hanging on had that many more customers, the galleries, that many, the people helped. It became synergistic. The boom improved the downtown. So what about the cost side? Well, Glad you asked. A downtown, and by the way, this is a very old study done for Brookings, but by a very reputable researcher, Duncan Associates. And we've updated the dollars to 2008 dollars, but one unit downtown, and this is also the east coast of Florida, but we think most of the trends would apply. A downtown unit in a place like West Palm Beach would be about $9,200 per unit. That's cost to government to enable that unit to be built. And at the bottom here, a unit way out in Wellington at the suburban edge would be about $23,000, or almost $24,000. So close to three times the cost to government to enable that unit to be built. And this shows the two things we were talking about in Sarasota. We're comparing these three downtown buildings with 357 units out here, out by the highway. And just to get a feel for the return on investment, in the first year, those three downtown buildings pay off fully a third of the county's outlay, whereas the buildings out on the edge take just 2%, and that's without interest. If you run it out to the life of the loan, and let's call it a loan from the taxpayers to the developers to enable this to happen, those three buildings downtown are paid off completely in 3 years, money back to the taxpayers, and the buildings out on the edge, it's taking 42 years, and that does not include paying any interest. So it's a tax, it's an interest-free loan from Sarasota County taxpayers to the developer. That's the power of the decisions that elected officials make when they approve projects like this. And they wonder why the finances are so thin. A lot of people say, oh, it's pension funds causing the problems. I believe it's the cost of suburban infrastructure. We don't even know if those buildings are going to last 42 years. And here's why. The downtown infrastructure, the road on the left, at the base of that new building is 100 years old. They may have dug a 6-inch trench to put some fiber optic cabling in. That probably was the cable company. Wouldn't have cost us anything. Whereas that road out on the edge, built for those three office buildings and the 357 units, when I took that photograph, standing there for 5 minutes, not a single car came by. Here on the left, moving cars, parked cars, people dining at the restaurants, lots of activity. It's an ecosystem on the left. On the right, everything's purpose-built for with those impact fees. So again, though, don't go thinking, oh, let's just build a lot of tall buildings. You got to have the market to fill them. And fortunately, Sarasota, the city, did a lot of smart things previously in terms of streetscape improvements, planting trees, restriping the parking. People love being downtown. You could walk in the shade on a hot summer day, and that was important. So, lots of things working together to make the downtown a real cash cow for the county, even though it's not our controlled property. So is this just Sarasota? Is it a one-off case, or could we look nationally? And my colleague Joe Minicozzi in Asheville, who did this work, has done work all over the country and done a number of projects out in the Rocky Mountain West, much smaller places. Nine of them, but this one here, Grand Junction, Colorado. Here are the numbers from Grand Junction, and even though the order of magnitude is much lower, what you see is that the properties at the bottom, the county residential, a whopping $177, city residential up to $1,000, condo $1,150. You move up the chart, one of the highest earners, 300 Main, is a two-story building in downtown. It's where it's located that gives it its value. And again, property taxes are typically based on the value of the building, which is a combination of both the location and the quality of the building. But there's no magic to this. If you're creating high-value real estate, you're going to be collecting a lot of taxes, unless, of course, you're in a place where they've somehow jiggered the system differently, more tax for this use versus another. So basically, the statistic, less than 7 acres of the downtown property would yield as much property tax revenue as a 95-acre mall. Here, overall, over those nine cities, these are the results. And far and away, the big earners were the 2- and 3-story mixed use. We're not talking towers. This is the Rocky Mountain West. And those of you who write quickly, this is the link to get that study. Joe's worked in California, similar things everywhere. So if we understand these factors that shape the tax base, how might we improve it going forward? How might we consciously redesign the system to optimize revenue return? Well, you know, smart growth does that, and in many regions there are projects moving forward, both infill and new growth. But you know, typically in most regions there's only one or two. You go to Des Moines, Iowa, and you know, it might, and these will be all over the newspapers. It's like the public has only so much attention to give to these places, and you know, you pay a big firm to come and do a charrette, and there's transportation and outreach and legal, and it costs, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. It hasn't taken hold like wildfire. It's the right way to do it, but it's a very high-strung, difficult way to do it. And I know this as a consultant who's typically out part of teams trying to pitch these things. What do you do for all, and by the way, it happens usually when government has tried everything else. They've tried the cheap approach, do it ourselves, let the developer do it, and citizens still aren't happy, and they say, no, we really want you to hire this fancy design firm that does the rendering in the upper right. Well, what about all the places that nobody cares about? What about all the low-value places? What about all the this sort of trickle of projects that come through local government getting approvals, building another, you know, another Chick-fil-A or another, you know, those incrementally are what destroy our communities. How do we, and a lot of times those are losing us money. How do we prevent that? Well, I had a thought, what about having a method of regulation that addresses these places and really works off this statistic right here. If government's shelling out money from its own pocket to enable development to happen, shouldn't it have a say in how quickly that money comes back? I mean, governments are incorporated as businesses, just like you know, regular businesses are. The only difference is it has a land asset that is trying to turn into the dollars that maintain the services in the community. What if you said, well, we recognize it'll be more than 3 years, but by gosh, it's got to come back earlier than 42 years. What if we said maybe 10 years? This number, the years of payback, let's call it a fiscal impact quotient, FIQ. Those would be the number of years required to pay back. We would let each municipality choose the return it wanted. We would try to standardize the methodology for calculating it, though. And basically, you would either ask for a quicker payback period if you're desperate, or actually, if you knew it was going to produce better urbanism, you might ask for it for that reason. But this becomes a new metric. And I have a whole presentation that gets into all the details of it. You know where to find me. But, you know, this idea of a new metric, it hasn't been part of the discussion. When we bring projects forward through zoning, we're only looking at impacts. You don't have an accountant there doing the math on how much is this thing going to earn at any moment. Sometimes you'll have fiscal neutrality statements, but those are very easily jiggered. And if government's not in a mood to challenge them, if budgets are tight and you don't have the staff freed up to spend 3 weeks crunching it, or you don't have a budget to hire your own consultant, those often are ignored, particularly if staff knows that the electeds really want that project to get approved. So here's a way it might be used. Let's look north to New Hampshire. They have an amazing tool on the web. You can look at this when you, actually those of you who are online can find it right now. New Hampshire Cost of Sprawl Index. Let's work through this. It's a really cool deal, very user-friendly. Let's select a municipality. Let's go to Bristol, New Hampshire. Here we are in Bristol. Let's highlight a few squares. Each grid square stands for 40 acres. And we've just highlighted it. Let's tell the program what we want to put there. We want to put some single-family detached. We want to put some attached multifamily, 160 units, 290 units of big multifamily. We're going to have some commercial. We just go through and we paint the page with the stuff we think would be fun. We've got 209 acres selected, 87 acres remaining. It spits out some pie charts telling us what we've selected. That's cool. And then it goes down and it starts telling us how much infrastructure. Well, you're going to need 4 miles of water and roads, 5.8 for sewer because the sewer plant's a little off the road. Look at this. Additional population, 1,768 people. 203 school children. You know, watch out for those kids. They're expensive. Average housing density, a lot of information. Here's the bottom line, guys. Total municipal and sewer costs, without water and sewer, $3,873, $3 million. With water and sewer, you're over $4 million. Total local property taxes paid, just under $1.3 million. Uh-oh. Do the math. How much going out? Almost 3.9 million, money coming in 1.29, difference of 2.5 million. That's big money. That's big money. Who is that developer? Does he need to be approved, or she? Now, the NIMBYs armed with this, in the old days, the best the NIMBYs could hope for was to make the project smaller. There's a new thing called the no-build option. Okay, clearly, in this case, the no-build option is going to be the route they take when people see that reducing the size of the project makes the pain worse for local government. Let's try it again. Let's see if we can make one cash flow positive. Let's go right to the heart of Manchester, one of the biggest cities. Let's click on some squares right over the interstate. Here we go. Let's put the densest thing we can put. Big apartment building, 600 units, kaboom, retail, office. There we go. Let's see what it gives us. Here we go. Those are the pie charts. Infrastructure. How is it we got 1.3 miles of roads and water? Gee, I guess there's a ways to the sewer plant. Or maybe because we're so close to the freeway, we have to loop around. Got some population, less school children. Well, we're doing better here. 1.8 million in terms of total costs without water, sewer, taxes, 843. We're still short by 977. We're closer to a 50-50 balance. The previous one was a 1-3. It was really bad. So you see the direction you have to go to make these things pencil out. And mind you, this is broad brush. This is not a precise tool. This would not be precise enough for the county, for instance, to say, okay, here's the amount of the check you need to write to make it all better. But it shows broad brush what the problem is. Now, assuming you could get these places to pencil, which we now know more about it, where would you put this kind of high-value development I'm talking about? Well, the first place you'd probably put it would be in downtowns. And Sarasota, as I said, has low buildings. But for us at the county, we don't control the regulatory process in downtown. That's another group of people, another local government. To us, the municipalities just look gray. We're all the stuff that's colored out there. How do we get development to happen out where we are? Well, we built these expensive roads. The problem is nobody wants to live on these roads. And we've just learned that Big Box, which loves to be on those roads, doesn't pay any more in taxes than single-family houses. So that's not a real proposition for us. Well, the answer is transit. Through transit, we can possibly create places on our real estate that'll give us a better return. But, you know, this picture from the upper right, that's Portland, Oregon, the great center for sustainability. Our citizens took one look at that picture and said, no, not for us. Make it better. And here's another picture from San Jose. It might be more pleasing, more appropriate for Sarasota. Well, I want to run through, in the time I have left, a couple of case studies to just show the incredible opportunity that exists when you put transit out into, you know, relatively moderate density suburban places. We're going to go to Pasadena, a place not unlike Bethesda. Here's a study that Dina Belzer did for some folks looking at feasibility of a streetcar that would link to the Gold Line. Just for reference, the Green Line here is the Gold Line traveling on city streets till it drops down into the canyon for the 210 freeway. This purple line here is the proposed streetcar. And what Dina's study did is she looked at all the real estate within 1,000 feet of that purple line. She evaluated the stuff that would be in red near-term, green mid-term, and blue long-term, and priced that real estate. And what she found is that today the value is just under $200 million. And by the way, the system costs about $200 million to build, but the feds would probably cover 80%. That was the hope. So it's really just $20 million. Too much pressure to do math. You guys will figure it out. With the addition of the streetcar, it immediately jumps up to $901 million. It quadruples. Now, Pasadena has a residential growth cap, very severe. It's very close to the heights of what things are already. Dina said, but you know, if you could let that cap out just a little bit, we can get your $901 million up to $3.2 billion. So look at that. Wow. The addition of the streetcar and the revenue generating potential of those fairly compact buildings downtown creates an incredible return. That increased property value and revenue comes entirely from transit and the decisions of elected officials. How many electeds are here right now? Raise your hands. Don't be shy. Okay, well, I hope they watch the video. It was a cheap study. It was a local Friends of Streetcar. They begged Dina to do it for less than her rate, $50,000. And she does great work, by the way. But the important thing is that it opens up the opportunity. People can see what could be earned. However, as compelling as this is, do not go overboard, particularly as you let out that growth cap. Let me show why. Height, if you put too much height in, it can backfire on you. Let me show you with some diagrams. And something funny is going on with my slides. If you go with too low of a height limit, if you've got one- and two-story buildings and your limit is two stories, people have very little incentive to improve their properties. Probably won't happen. Or, you know, take them down and start over. If you give them a floor or two, and then they'll say, well, it behooves me to tear down my building and put up a new one. However, don't follow that logic to its illogical conclusion and go up to 10 stories or 15, because the problem is, that going too high actually hurts economic development. This is counterintuitive. Too low hurts economic development, too high. Why is that? Well, let's think about it. The developers suddenly have 10, 12 stories. The problem is its paper value. The value of their land has increased because they can put more on it, but the market doesn't exist. And this is the same problem Montgomery has with some of its further out TODs. They're going to be great TOD sites. The market isn't there yet. And so when you put a high growth cap on them, what you're saying is you can build up to 10 stories. The market only exists for two. It's going to be a long wait. What you've really just done is a development moratorium in the form of what looks like a gift to the developer. And the developer, of course, can go out and refinance the property. They have all kinds of things they can play on the financial side. This is what happens in Texas. You know, you have, this is Houston. We all know about their lack of zoning there. What happens, they're legendary for their boom-bust cycles. When you can build a great big building, the first guy in, the first developer in after the recession gets the big law firm, all the big tenants, and the other three developers who are reading the same market studies, their properties come on, there's nobody to fill the space. So it's counterintuitive. As planners, we think if we want density, we should zone for density. Not really. It's like letting out your belt. If you're feeling the pinch, you let it out one or two notches. If you let it out too many notches, your pants fall down. Now, I'm not showing the visual on that. But what I am is I'm showing the visual of a lot of plans. And again, this is what I learned being a new urbanist for a few years and being a staff planner for a few years. This happens a lot. San Diego, at the peak of the boom. Okay, developers were complaining, we don't have the density. They upzoned dramatically without any design controls. And guess what? It's going to be a long time before the developers are motivated to start building again in San Diego because they have the entitlements for 40-story buildings, but the market's only there for six. So that gap retards development. Okay, let me keep going. Contra Costa County. I want to give myself another plug here. This is a project where I was consultant to the county. There was a lot of talk about TOD in the late 90s, early 2000s. Very few got built. Some of them failed. This is one that succeeded, I'm happy to say. There were NIMBYs that blocked the development of this for 20 years. We managed to get a fairly robust project built. The county had a parking requirement that every surface parking space had to get replaced. So a 1,200-car parking garage, you see it on the right, doubled in size to a 2,500-car parking garage. Well, with a monster garage like that, we'd better have a darn good plan. And I think we did. But the key to making this project work was the fact that it had great urban design, actually, oddly enough, done by a consultant here in the Maryland area, Seth Harry, who works out of Frederick now, who came for the Charette. We had a good outreach. Bill Leonards, now of the Charette Institute, ran the project. And we had form-based codes. Jeff Farrell, also located in D.C., did the form-based codes. This was the Charette scene. Here's the project as it's built, very similar to the renderings, and it won an APA National Award for implementation, I'm pleased to say. Here locally, you all know about this. There's firms that are really good at this stuff. The Pike and Rose project, not far from here at the White Flint Metro, part of your White Flint plan. I see it going up. Just a review of its earning power, and I got these numbers from Federal, and they said, don't tell them they're carved in stone. They're based on estimates of what we think might be built. But we know that before construction, it paid almost $9.9 million which is 800,000. Phase one completion, and those buildings are going up right now. It'll be bringing in 3.4 million in taxes, so tripling and more, almost quadrupling. Full build out, they're thinking 15 million in taxes. And by the way, these images supplied by Federal, I think it's a pretty good plan. They actually show some understanding of perimeter block buildings as opposed to towers. Montgomery has a mania for towers, but from an efficiency standpoint, perimeter block are a much better way to build your community. Well, I want to tell you, this densification I'm talking about that looks so good, it doesn't always make sense. Beware. And again, I actually knew this before I worked in government, but it drove the point home. Here we are in Sarasota. This project started just as I was joining the staff. I had to tell my boss, Jim, who loved this project of densifying one of their big corridors. You know, we start with a big strip. Let's put some head-in parking, create a slip lane, street trees, low buildings, parking, all the activity, great stuff. Okay, here's our new BRT, all this stuff going on. Okay, well, folks, it looks wonderful, and yes, there's some tax base there. Do not do this. Why not? Well, if you look at an aerial photo of the region, what you'll see is the B Ridge, which is one of only three arterials that go east-west from a major interstate to the downtown, which is along the water. Just north of it is a neighborhood that has no through roads. The arterials are spaced about a mile apart. And so when people hit a backup, the first thing they do is go down these roads, as I did when I first started working there. I was staying further south and driving an hour in every day for the first couple weeks. But you discover there's no through roads. We don't have the grid. So it's just like when you know your varicose veins get operated on, they remove the arteries and you go, well, where does all the blood go? Well, the capillaries take it up and new veins form. If you don't have the connectivity though, new veins cannot form. And so you're thwarted. And guess who they'll blame? Even though it's probably not even the development, when they look around and see all that great infill stuff, they'll go, see, we told you this wouldn't work. And what I told Jim is, I said, if you've only got the depth of one block to do this, you won't have the housing to drive the transit and so on. So again, you'll get great tax base, but you'll only do it once before the citizens and the commuters go berserk. And politically, that will shut you down. So not recommended. What do you do if you don't have great transit? Even BRT is pretty expensive. This is the Euclid line in Cleveland. And by the way, a lot of people say you got to do streetcars to get the return. The big feedback from Euclid is it's not streetcar versus BRT, it's how much do you spend? Are you improving the corridor? If you do that, you'll get the return in terms of land use, but there's this thing called the new mobility. There's a lot of talk about car share, bike share, Uber, smartphones. Tom Downs, who's here in the region, has this great quote. He says, walking, biking, and transit are about to become the next wave of transportation to shape our urban areas. Combined, they create a new mode. And the beauty of combining these things is that unlike a streetcar line, which costs a fortune, these things are cheap. Car share, bike share, these are contracts between local government and vendors. It really doesn't take a lot of money. You might have to develop an app to synchronize them. So my colleague Joe down in Asheville, thinking about their downtown, did this study looking at revenue return. Ignore the red, it's a statistical glitch. But what he did is essentially, this is not the heights of the buildings. The height of the bar is how much revenue each use returns. So similar to this chart here. So what we see is that this building built in the 80s when they had stiff parking requirements downtown, they needed 5.2 acres to be able to build that Renaissance hotel because of all the parking. In the 90s, the parking requirements went away. Look at how tall that bar is. Look at the revenue return. There's no parking in that building. They presume they've got a reasonable bus system. They've got walkable streets. People are living downtown. They're talking about car share, bike share. If you created a downtown mobility district and you just waive those requirements away with these features and an app, so you might invest like Strasbourg did, you have the possibility of bringing all those bars that are low, bringing them up. That would be millions, billions for a small downtown like Asheville. Let's go deeper. What do you do when you don't even have mixed use, when you're at the neighborhood level? Well, I've been paying close attention to this neighborhood that I'm hoping to buy a house in soon, called Parkwood. Kensington Parkwood's the school. You know, it's lovely, tree-lined streets, reasonably narrow sidewalks, street trees, and again, that great school. Well, the housing stock isn't high-end. It's pretty modest. These were post-war houses, designed to be added to, but very cookie-cutter. You see a lot of this in Montgomery. And in the 60s and 70s and 80s, when people added to them, they weren't very nice. But amazing things happened in the 90s and 2000s and now 2010s is the quality of the renovations of these houses is getting really, really good. These houses are doubling and tripling in value, which annoys the people in the smaller houses, but guess what? It's paying the bills. Here's some of the new houses. This is a Tom Cosgrove, a builder who lives in that house on the corner. You see the low house next to it? People are complaining. It's a grassroots effort. These are my neighbors doing this work. That's Margaret Upton. I see her walking my kid to school. She's out walking her dog. The builders, the architects, they're all in the neighborhood. A lot of them work at home. They used to work in the big fancy offices. This is Rob Narabecki, who's in that photo up top. His company, some of his before and afters. You see the little house. I always like to look to try to see the relationship between what he started with and what he ended with. Here's one of Margaret's. Really great stuff, and it's homegrown effort. The builders, the big guys that come in and just tear down the house because they get a little more for it. These folks want to save the house, which keeps the build to line, keeps a lot of the character. I don't have a before for this one. All it really needs to make them even better is mixed use. But I learned that in your zoning update, the idea of small neighborhood mixed use clusters, which will allow a lot of seniors to be able to age in place, was roundly booed and hissed. I still think it's a good idea. I live here now. I'll probably push this one. But it's key to control the design, and zoning doesn't do that. Form-based codes do, zoning doesn't. So you really need to get down to it. So I know they're standing around saying, Peter, finish up. Let me just try to wind this up thoughtfully. This message of focusing on the revenue from bigger buildings didn't go over well in Sarasota. A lot of these people are put in office by developers who build this type of thing. And by the way, when you do this on the waterfront, it doesn't count because it hurts the values of things behind you. The DC region gets this concept completely, and I thought coming here would be great. But I learned about something called incentive zoning that messes up the whole works. Proffers, exactions, extractions, think of your dentist doing an extraction, public benefit, all the communities in the region do some form of this. There are different names. Proffers, I'm told, are technically illegal here in Montgomery, but it's all about asking the developer, can you pay for this plaza? We need some money for affordable housing. Can you build a conference room in your building for the community? All these great things, okay, that are done without your tax dollars being involved. Seems like a good idea, but wait a minute, let's think about this for a minute. It's a bit of a fool's paradise. What happens is the electeds, in communities I know, I'm going to speak of Arlington, will keep the zoning down because citizens get nervous when the zoning on their little bungalow goes up to four stories. So let's leave it at two stories, because what that means is that when a developer comes in for that special review, that alternative path that takes 2 years, well, after the special review, they can go up to 12 stories. Huge windfall. Not really, because they're paying millions for the privilege. So a handful of lots in the area might go to that rather high height, which is way above that two-story as of right. There's probably a norm of about six stories, which if you really zone for it, that's what you do. But again, and certain developers aren't going to go down that route. Their banks won't let them keep the money out for 3 years. They got to get something going. So they'll start with a two-story building, which is really lower than what belongs in that neighborhood. So the problem with this system is that this handful of buildings is earning at very high rates, particularly when they are occupied and sold. The problem is all that land that's undeveloped or underdeveloped is trading at a discount because the developer knows they're going to have to spend several million dollars when it comes approval time to pay for all these goodies that the citizens in the county wants. It factors into the land price, and guess what that does? There's a lot more of those undeveloped and underdeveloped sites, and so as a result, it's a fool's paradise because all those sites are now selling at a discount. And it means they also appraise at a discount, which means that the entire municipal tax base is suppressed. So the money you thought you were getting from those greedy developers, you actually are taking from yourself in the entire tax base, and you're not just doing it 1 year, you're doing it year after year after year. Now, I'm not here shilling for developers. A lot of them do things I don't care for, but what I am here advocating is I'm going to skip ahead of these. Let's ask for what we want. Let's indicate the height we really want. Let's design precise. Let's say we want the town square there, and we'll pay for it. If it's private land, we'll pay for it. And we'll let the developers make good money on what they build. It will be a plan that we will create in conjunction with citizens and local government. We'll all agree that it's the very best plan. We'll know where everything goes because we're using a form-based code. We'll know the building types. They will be often pre-approved in the municipality. We'll have the policies specified, but we'll be clear about all this. This is physical planning versus policy planning. And unfortunately, one of the big things I learned in my tour of duty as a planner around the country is that local government does not do physical planning. They will order that from outside consultants from time to time. They're attempting to use policies to shape our environment, and it doesn't work very well. To me, that's one of the big innovations of new urbanists, and one of the reasons why I got in all kinds of trouble for writing this article years ago for APA called Beyond the Priesthood. But at any rate, I want to make a pitch for government. It's moving in the right direction from policy planning towards physical planning. I want to touch on this notion about experts. In the last 10 minutes, I've said a few things that probably raised a few eyebrows in this room, particularly among the planners. Thank you so much for inviting me. It may be the last time I present in front of an audience in Montgomery County, but at least I had one chance. That business of experts being from far away, the good news about those people is at the end of their presentation, they get on a plane and they go away. They don't show up at local meetings. They don't heckle you from the crowd. They do stick to their time limits, and I apologize for going over. But at any rate, I will be here in the county for at least a few years, and I look forward to being involved. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Because we're running late, we won't have a chance for questions, but I think Peter's going to be here for the duration of the conference, and if you have questions, feel free to talk with him. We promised you provocative, and we certainly got that. The sessions are now beginning. There are three rooms. There is this room, the other room on this same floor, and the Fenton room on one floor up. In your conference brochure, it explains which room each of the sessions is in. So please go, have a great day, and we look forward to a lot of exciting conversations.